Hello everyone, once again welcome to our new installment of the beautiful City Press product called Books and Beverages. My name is Fred Kumalo, I'm the host for the show. And today in the studio I'm joined by a newly minted author and lawyer, Bulelwa Mabasa. She's going to be telling us about her writing journey, but more specifically about her new book called My Land Obsession. It's just hit the shelves, and we ran an extract in City Press. Those of you who might have missed it are most welcome to revisit it. It's online, and it's available, and it's very engaging. So, Sis Bulelwa, welcome once again to City Press Books and Beverages. To get the ball rolling, I would like us, before we get into the book itself, being a new author, tell us about your writing journey. Why did you decide to write this book, and how was your writing journey? What were the challenges and whatever?
The process. Whatever,
the process. Yeah.
So I have always been intentional about wanting to be an attorney and being part of a voice in social justice. But what I hadn't uttered and what I had never verbalized was my secret hope and passion for writing, because I just feel like it's such a vulnerable process. You know, I write every day. I mean, we write briefs to clients,
obviously,
we write letters,
yes.
But never did I imagine that one day I would have to put my story in a non-fiction way and about a subject that I was so passionate about. So I did not decide to write. I think when I was approached by a publisher at Penn Macmillan, they said, you know, we think you have a good story to tell. You're one of the few black women who have risen through the ranks in a male-dominated attorney's practice. Write about your career. So I was supposed to write about my career.
Yes.
But then when I started the writing journey, it just felt that it just cannot be a story about I went to the school, I went to varsity. Then it felt to me that I needed to pause and reflect about my history and my heritage, because that's where I can trace and track the beginnings of what ultimately led to me as a woman, as a mother, as a wife. And so I then took a chance and said, you know, they wanted to write me to write about my career and my involvement in land reform, but the only way that made sense for me in telling the story is was to personalize it.
Sure.
You know, and to move it away from a political debate, mainly, or the debate about expropriation and parliament. So it actually helped me heal and trace back the roots of where it all began. Because it just was not about, the story doesn't start with me writing, you know, me becoming a lawyer or writing a book. It needed me to trace back those roots. And the process was very difficult. I think this was the most difficult piece of writing that I ever needed to do, because it was so personal, and it needed me to draw from deep within.
Sure.
And to go to those corners that I've packed away in my mind, some of it trauma, some of it just also realizing that the challenges that I've been through. So it was, but ultimately it was cathartic.
Cool. Thank you. Now, the title itself speaks volumes, to use the pun, My Land Obsession. And I'm reading this book, I'm a township boy myself.
Yeah.
I'm kind of removed from the issue of the land. I only engage at a very intellectual level about the land, because I have never been, I have never had access to the land. I was born in a township, raised in a township. Yeah.
Mm.
So why did you choose to write about land? How do you relate to the land, being a suburban a woman?
Mm.
Yeah.
So in my formative years, I used to stay in Zone 4 Meadowlands with my grandparents.
Yes, yes.
And my parents. And that would have been from, say, 1979 till 1986. Now, I've always been a curious child. And there was this painting at home with the, I don't know if it's the painter called Verna, but in most townships, there was this painting of a black girl or a black boy with a teardrop.
Yes,
and then this painter. You remember that
very
one?
Very well, yeah. Iconic here.
Yes. Yes, so I saw that painting and I was just curious as a 5-year-old, you know, and I asked my father to say, you know, why is this girl crying? Because she just looked like she could be me. Mm-hmm. And my father said she's crying because her land was taken away from her. And it's only when I started writing the book that I remembered all of that.
Wow.
And time goes on, I felt, for some reason, maybe that was the root or that was the thing that just stayed with me. And then I remember then growing up and feeling like in the career that I'm going to choose, I'm going to need to speak for her, that landless black child, black girl. And so then my father just bombarded me. He knew that I loved to read. So he bombarded me with African literature. Mm-hmm. So I remember Mongane Serote's To Each Birth Its Blood and
yes,
Chinua Achebe and Nguki wa Kiyongo. And for me, in those books, that theme continued around colonization and land dispossession.
Land dispossession, yes.
So then I grappled with this. And then I grew up, I become a teenager, and then there's the fall of the Berlin Wall, and my father and I are engaging about this. And then I get to university, now I'm studying law, and I thought, when I'm studying law, I'm going to learn about the Native Land Act, the Group Areas Act. But it didn't happen. Mm. It was not there in the syllabus. But I couldn't stop remembering my grandparents who were forcibly removed from Sophiatown in the 50s, telling me the stories about how they forcibly removed. My grandfather talking about how his life was as a mine worker and the, you know, those indignified body searches. And then in the holidays, my mother came from a village called Marapiane. Then I go to Marapiane and I'm like, this
where,
land is
where
different.
Is this? Which province?
Marapiane
is this
initially was northwest, but it's in Mpumalanga. It's just before, towards Petersburg.
Sorry, okay.
Bolokwane.
Okay.
You can tell I'm old. I still say Petersburg.
So
then I see the land being vastly different from Soweto. Soweto is densified and it's 3-room, 4-room houses. It's literally next to each other. Then I go to Marapiane and it's like this big land, this grazing land. But they use long jobs. There's no sanitation. There's no electricity. So I was always just drawn from how differently life was from Middlelands to Marapiane. And the fact that in Marapiane they were, you know, getting water from underground. They had a pump. But they were also feeding themselves from the ground. And so I think all of these things. And then I start to go to school in a multiracial school in 1994. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that suburbia is vastly different.
Different world altogether.
Altogether.
Yeah,
like, you could hear birds chirp.
Yes.
But I didn't realize that in Middlelands, because there were no trees, and the reason because there were no trees, people built big back rooms, you're not going to attract birds.
Exactly.
Singing.
Exactly.
So that metaphor on land and my exposure to it and what my father had said kind of recorded in my head over and over again. And also with my political inclination, I was always interested in politics. I was always interested in social justice. And that's when I did my postgraduate at Wits for Constitutional Law, I chose to do it on comparing the Zimbabwe-Lancaster Agreement to our constitution. Then it was brand new. Mm-hmm. When I was first year university in 1997, our constitution had just been promulgated.
1 year, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so for me, it was like, okay, what can this constitution do? Maybe the land question.
Okay, many of our listeners out there who read City Press, some of them are just plain readers. Others are aspiring authors as well, who will cherish some thoughts, some ideas as to how you, I mean, not at a practical level, how you embarked on writing the book.
First, yeah.
Yes. Do you sit every day at a given time? Do you have a ritual around your writing?
So, first of all, I started writing in December 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Was it 2020? And remember now, I've got 3 children. I'm married. I've got an attorney's practice. It's busy every day. I've got a team.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, because I'm a nocturnal person, I chose to write when everybody went to bed. Because I just love that silence of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And I would spend maybe 2 hours just writing. And then other moments felt like I need to be away from the writing because I didn't want to ever feel like I'm just writing intellectually. I needed to feel what I was writing. So there were moments when I needed to stay away from it. But I think what I remember the most is just the vulnerability, you know, of it. And I think I switched off from one day this book is going to be read by others because I think that's what made me anxious.
Yes.
Then I was like, no, let me just write my story. And I forgot about it's going to be published one day. Other people are going to have views about it. Other people are going to. So my ritual was mainly the dead of night. I couldn't write every day. I didn't have. Sometimes it's just not impossible. It was just impossible to write every single
every day.
Yeah,
you're drained, you're tired. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay. But my rhythm, the best times where I wrote the most was at night in the let's say between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m.
Okay.
Those were my times when I just felt so connected with myself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And different writers have got different habits and so on. Others would write a draft and give to a friend. Do you have a primary reader as you were writing? How did it work for you?
I didn't have a primary reader. So obviously I had my publisher, Andrea Natris, from Penn.
Yes.
And I would write a chapter and send. But I deliberately wanted it to be so organic that I didn't want to give it to my husband to read before and give permission, or my sisters, or even my children.
Yeah.
The first time that I had someone other than the publisher reading it was my husband, and he read it overnight. He finished the book overnight.
Yeah.
But it was just when I submitted the manuscript. So I didn't want it to be colored and textured by what other people would think.
Yes.
Or, you know, I really just wanted to be my, like I was giving birth to my organic child.
Sure.
So I didn't want the child to come out being having so-and-so's hands and arms, you know.
Yeah. So now, but there's a lot of autobiography in the book.
Mm.
So were you not concerned, or did you have to interview family members or just to jog your memory, to remind you and stuff like, did you have to do that?
So I did do that in relation to my maternal grandfather, because remember, I'm growing up in Midlands, Soweto.
Yes.
So certain facts about the background of my maternal grandfather, who was in Marapiane in that village, needed to be corroborated. But it happened organically, so we would go to Marapiane because maybe there's a cousin's wedding, or maybe there is a funeral that we're attending. I use those opportunities to say, you know, Rangwane, tell me, you know, remind me, jog my memory, where was Ntate from, you know. So that I did, but it was not formal. It was an organic process. And I did want to use memory as my tool.
Yes.
Because I think memory, how you remember things is what's going to determine how you feel about them and ultimately how you write about them.
Exactly.
So I didn't want to distort what I perceive to have been my memory, to be distorted by someone else saying, no, but in actual fact, when you were five, that painting, you know, in the kitchen was not in the kitchen, it was in the bathroom, for example. So it was literally me going back to my five-year-old self and how I remember things.
Yes,
and I'm pretty sure that there'll be inaccuracies.
I wanted to own my memory.
Yeah,
beautiful. And did you, as you were writing, did you have a reader in mind to say, this is the kind of reader I'm trying to appeal to, and this is how they are going to read the book?
Yeah.
Did you have that?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
So in my formative years, I was hoping to capture the reader whose gogo umkulu grew up, was the neighbor to my mawe and tata, who says, oh man, this is our story. This is our shared story.
Yes.
And this is a story about a lot of people who are unseen and unheard, right? And then as I grew up, I thought about the Black generation of, you know, us who matriculated in 96, right at the dawn of democracy. I also wanted to document the trauma that we experienced in these so-called white schools.
Yeah.
Remember, our parents, we probably couldn't even afford it, but they wanted us to go to those schools because they wanted to secure our futures. But what I wanted to capture is that quest for equal education and opportunity, how much it, of us it ate away from, you know. being reminded that you don't belong here, mm-hmm. being reminded that, mm-hmm. you know, don't speak that language here. You know, that sense of belonging that we grew up with. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to capture that same generation now when we were out of school and we were now at university. I think I speak about the TKZs, the Tebes, the Mdus, that at that point from 96 onwards, and it was the foundation of the beginnings of YFM, that was our rebellion. You know, that was when we I think, found that we have permission to embrace our blackness. Because remember, we're in these schools, we needed to twang, you needed to be, you know, proximity to whiteness.
Yep.
But then when we came of age at university and in these spaces, we claimed back. And that's why I think the lyrical content of TKZ, you know, boys who were from private schools, was so important, because that was saying we embrace our blackness and we embrace where we come from and we love who we are becoming. So that's another audience that I wanted to capture. And then when I then moved to in a law firm, I'm speaking to the legal fraternity there.
Sure.
I'm speaking to certain practices that are even archaic. I speak to practices that make it difficult for women to stay in the profession because of the demands and because it's so male-dominated that hopefully a child or a man, even a woman who wants to become an attorney, can see that the challenges, you know, I state them in a very honest way, you know. And I think also, I also speak to people who want to know, well, how do you then build a whole practice around land reform in a corporate commercial firm, you know? Uh-huh. And I think I share those experiences. And I basically, the message is for, and I think it goes beyond the law profession. I think anyone who is in corporate in South Africa, where our economy is still in the hands of the white minority, how then do we interact with those spaces as black people? And how, what tools we need to, you know, kind of keep pushing. And in my case, it was because land reform has inhabited me all my life. If I'm to stay in attorney's practice, I must find a way to make it real and make it a sustainable practice. So where my profession and my passion can live together.
Sure.
So it's all of those different people that I was thinking about. I was also thinking about my elders who are still alive, you know. At the end of the book, I discover that my long-lost adopted grandmother was the first admitted female attorney all of South Africa in 1967.
Wow.
And this information is not well known, you know. So I think I appeal to everyone. I think there is something for everyone to either find in relation to or people to see themselves in the story as well.
Cool. And the subject matter itself is very sensitive. We saw how it was mishandled in Zimbabwe, if it was mishandled, the kind of problems that it generated and so on. Do you think we are handling the issue properly in South Africa, the land reform question? What are the challenges?
We are not. And, you know, I'm not giving political views because I'm not a politician, but I mean, this is just what personally that I think happened. Mm-hmm. I think when the government of the day came into power, they had bread and butter issues to deal with, electrifying the country, you know, providing health care and education. And I think that the land question, it neglected. Whether that was neglected by design, or, you know, or by error, I can't say. But what I noticed was that when, you know, almost farming became a metaphor for land reform. And that always bugged me because I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, but look at Alex Township, look at the townships in Middlelands, the back rooms, people are living in back rooms, or even the people that have hijacked buildings in town. Mm. And I looked at the fact that the densification in urban areas, people, like more than 65% of people want to be in urban areas because that's where the economic nodes are. Then I look at how it's being implemented, and then I look at how it's been spoken about. Then I look at how it's treated in the press. It's either, you know, the only extreme positions that make it. But I just found that there was no rational voice that says, okay, we've got this land reform as part of something that needs to happen as per the Constitution, but I just never saw anyone take ownership of it, even within, you know, within government. The policies were just unclear. Each minister had its own ideas about how to go about it. And so even some of the legislative requirements, like, for example, let me give you a very, you know, example. There's a provision in the Constitution that says that the state must take measures to ensure that there is equitable redistribution. And we don't have any legislation. And the Constitution was born in 1996. Until today, we don't have that act because it was just never a priority. And then when you look at the
but this whole thing about expropriation without compensation?
So that whole thing, first of all, the concept of expropriation exists across the world. It's not new.
Yeah.
The only difference between South Africa and the rest of the world is that in the rest of the world, you use expropriation as a tool to gain land or property for a public purpose. If you want to build a school, a hospital, you use it as a tool to acquire that land. Now, our constitution is unique because it says that you must expropriate land for purposes of land reform. And land reform is taken to mean as to be something in the public interest. But as I said, I don't know where things went wrong, but I think also with expropriation without compensation, based on the current reading of the Constitution, even if you were to implement it to the letter, it's not going to open up vast land. It's not going to solve all land problems. It might work in a few situations where maybe the land is not used, or maybe where the land was donated, someone didn't actually buy it, or where there has been no direct state investment. But those instances are far and few in between. So that's why I said the overemphasis on expropriation without compensation was very hyperbolic. And it was very... Politics also played a role. I think parties wanted to be seen to be doing something about it. But at the end of the day, government has still not pushed itself to implement the three legs of land reform. Remember, expropriation is just one tool that can be used.
Yes, yes.
There's still restitution. Restitution where if you have your grandparents that were dispossessed of land, maybe in KZN or wherever, you can lodge a land claim. But currently we still have thousands and thousands of land claims that have been lodged that where people have not been given the land, or people have been given the land, they've now had to sell the land back because they're not given the post-settlement support. You still have a lot of people being evicted from land unfairly because they don't have legal representation, you know. It's the land reform question is still so litigious in a society where people don't have access to good legal representation.
They can't afford it.
They can't afford it. So it's still the power, the pace, and the substance of land reform is still concentrated amongst those that are able to access lawyers, advocates, and courts. So most of our problems actually are not even making it to that court because people just simply don't have the resources. So I think it has the executive and parliament have got to take more intentional effort at delivering it so that we don't end up with the courts having to be the arbiters in a situation where we have so many such inequality when it comes to legal representation.
Well, so how do we fix it? Is it fixable? As a legal person and as an activist, how do you think we can grapple with this challenge?
So number one, the state must utilize all its legislative powers. But I'll be the first person to say you don't change society by changing laws all the time. But you do need the laws. For example, you do need the Redistribution Act that tells us all who qualifies for land, under what circumstances, where, and who are those beneficiaries. We need that. We don't have that. So it's not one thing that we need to do. We need to do a lot of different things. Secondly, you need a proper urban land policy that allows, and these are the recommendations I made when I was part of the Presidential Advisory Panel, and as part of the panel, we made those recommendations to say, the state must release land and buildings that it currently has for the benefit of the citizens. And there's a commercial issue because those government departments also use that as their balance sheets to borrow money. So I understand that dichotomy. Uh-huh. But then number three, you also need to get to a point where our tenure system, so in other words, your land rights, such as title deeds or whatever, do you know that at the moment 80% of South Africans are not part of the deed registry?
80%.
In urban and rural areas, because they have informal land rights. Remember what the apartheid legacy was. What apartheid did is, if you are living in the rural areas on communal land, you don't have a title deed. You have a permission to occupy.
Oh yeah, we have the Ngonyama Trust. Yes, so you can't own land.
And in fact, the banks won't recognize the permission to occupy because the banks don't know how to use it as an instrument.
Exactly.
And if you're in the urban areas, you live in a backyard or whatever, some townships have title deeds, but most still don't. What that means is that, does South Africa truly, truly then belong to all? Or does South Africa belong to those that are in the formal economy? Like you'll have your lease, you'll have your mortgage bond, and so forth. And then, for me, what's also important is that those that are landowners that have vast land, it's also incumbent upon them to make land available. Mm-hmm. And this is, sounds like a ridiculous and wild allegation. But I've had people come to me in my offices to say, I'm a farmer. I own vast land. Where can I find people that I can donate the land to?
Really?
Some have said, so-and-so, Violet has worked in our family, has lived here. So have her parents and her children. We want to make... So also we need to appeal to the goodwill and conscience of people before we can want to falsely, you know, expropriate. Of course there's, but I think we need to deal with it also on a very human level to say, this problem is not just for black people or poor black people. If we're going to unite this nation, we are going to have to find solutions and appeal also to the conscience of those that know that they have more land than that they need. Mm-hmm. This is why in the presidential advisory panel, I suggested a land donations policy. Maybe it has to be also legislated so that it's clear, it goes to public consultation.
So it was just a recommendation at the
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think there is a draft policy, but I'm not sure whether that document has come to life. And I think... also, it's what you and I can do in our spaces. You know, I didn't know, when I was in the panel, I didn't know the concept of, it's called NIMBYism. NIMBYISM. You know what that means? Mm-hmm. Not in my backyard.
Oh, okay.
Not in my backyard means, if you are privileged, you have a home, you have a garden, you have a swimming pool, you'd say, yes, we must do land reform. But how open are you to say, I'm willing to close my swimming pool so that my home can house...
And you donate
it. It's a mindset shift because I think where we are right now, and of course government must do what government needs to do. But I think what if we actually imagined a world where we, whoever has, can also open up that space and open up that land so we can coexist. Because ultimately... that's what's going to determine if you're a true South African citizen. It's whether you have access to land. And maybe you don't need to own it, right? I don't know. But whether you have access to land, you're able to do your rituals. I mean, now, 20-something years after democracy, we're now able to have lobola celebrations in our suburban homes and to slaughter in our suburban homes.
Yes.
It's that whole idea of thinking about land beyond the rents and cents. But as... am I seen? Do I matter? Do I have a stake in this new South Africa?
Sure.
And where do I belong?
Cool. On that note, where do I belong? This is my land. This is our land. The subject here obviously is the book, My Land Obsession by Bulelwa Mabasa. It's on the shelves. You can get it. You can buy it online or wherever, but you have to read it to appreciate the candor of this writer explaining her love for the land that she occupies, and making suggestions as to how we can better appreciate and share the land. My land in obsession. Bulelwa Mabasa, and I'm Fred Kumalo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was an honor.
It was my honor.